540 AM Jackson, W266 DR Waukesha, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper. On Maui, residents returned to Lahaina, where at least 97 people died and thousands of acres burned in August wildfires. CBS's Jonathan Vigliotti is there.
At least a dozen people returned home. We're told at least one person in the neighborhood was unable to escape the flames alive.
Chuck Hogan's home survived.
Sorry. I get a little choked up sometimes about it.
Yeah, I understand.
Just because it's just so horrible. And the fact that I made it is, just the luck, the way the wind was blowing, basically.
Hogan, a contractor by trade, estimates it will take at least a decade to rebuild the town.
Congress faces a Saturday midnight deadline to avoid a government shutdown. Far-right House Republicans demanding cuts to food and housing programs have refused to support a continuing resolution supported by GOP House Speaker Kevin McCarthy, who says he doesn't want to risk a shutdown.
I think we're much stronger when we stay open. I don't understand how not paying the troops and not paying our border agents.
The Writers Guild of America reaches an agreement with the studios to end the almost five-month-long strike. The terms are not yet known. CBS's Elise Preston has more from Los Angeles.
Picket signs are coming down, but don't expect the curtain to rise anytime soon for your favorite shows. While the writers have reached a deal, it still must be ratified by the Guild's 11,000 members, and more than 160,000 actors are still without a contract. The WGA calls its three-year deal exceptional. It includes concessions on royalty payments for streaming and protecting writers from being replaced by AI.
Meantime, SAG-AFTRA represented actors are still on strike. The National Transportation Safety Board says it's going to investigate an incident on a JetBlue flight today. As it traveled from Ecuador to Fort Lauderdale, Florida, the jet experienced severe turbulence near Jamaica, injuring eight people on board. Anthony Brickhouse is an associate professor at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University.
Typically, when we see injuries and turbulence, it is passengers who were not buckled in. For whatever reason.
Brickhouse says that's why it's important for passengers to always keep their seatbelts buckled. He played quirky pathologist Dr. Donald Ducky Mallard on CBS's NCIS TV show. Emmy-nominated actor David McCallum died in a New York hospital today of natural causes. He was 90. McCallum, back in the 60s, starred in the spy drama The Man from U.N.C.L.E. He was born in Glasgow, Scotland, and trained as a musician before switching to drama. On Wall Street, the Dow closed up 43 points, NASDAQ jumped 60. This is CBS News.
You need to hire? Indeed is with you every step of the way, helping you attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one place. Visit Indeed.com/credit.
Looking for more local programming? Check out our website, civicmedia.us, to see our entire lineup.
With news on WAUK The Shaw, I'm Stuart J. Waddles. Milwaukee Lutheran High School has kids at home today following gunfire at a Friday night football game. Homecoming Saturday and weekend activities were also canceled. The game was called off in the fourth quarter Friday when shots were fired outside of the track area at around 9:20. Although no injuries were reported, the incident left parents and students shaken. The letter Milwaukee Lutheran sent home to parents said they canceled all of the activities as a precautionary measure. The owner of the Rock Sports Complex in Franklin is addressing ongoing noise complaints from neighbors. The CEO and owner of the complex says some neighbors may never be entirely satisfied with the situation. He does say he's open to finding solutions, including discussing acceptable noise levels and the possibility of sound barriers. With news on WAUK The Shaw, I'm Stuart J. Waddles.
Imagine wearing a shirt that's either too big or too small. It just doesn't feel right. And when it comes to your Medicare coverage plan, Smart Medicare Solutions understands that one size does not fit all. Your plan should be meticulously tailored to meet your specific needs. With a wide range of insurance providers to choose from, Smart Medicare Solutions can help find your perfect Medicare fit. Get clear, objective advice by logging on smartmedicaresolutions.com. Smart Medicare Solutions, guiding you through Medicare with general generations of expertise.
Here's to trekking through a kaleidoscope of fall color in Wisconsin. To being like, who's up for whitewater rafting? And turning stories into souvenirs. Here's to rich traditions made new again with good company. And seasonal flavors that taste even better when shared with friends. Here's to those who Wisconsin. Plan your fall getaway at TravelWisconsin.com. Sponsored by Travel Wisconsin.
If I could be you.
And you could be me.
For just 1 hour.
If you could find a way.
To get inside.
Each other's mind.
Walk a mile in my shoes.
Walk a mile in my shoes.
Walk a mile in my shoes.
We've all felt left out. And for some, that feeling lasts more than a moment. We can change that. Learn how at belongingbeginswithus.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Walk a mile in my shoes.
Vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. Going to start off with a sad note. One of my favorite people in the labor movement, Tom Conway, president of the International Steelworkers Union. He passed away today. As head of the United Steelworkers, was a guy who was always forward-looking, always out there fighting for members, fighting for better opportunities, and it's a sad day. He was 71 years old, so our thoughts, our prayers, our hopes go out to his family and to the steelworker family on this day. Some good news today, however, the Writers Guild. They have a tentative agreement. There's something they're taking back to the members, which means that could be ending. That strike could be ending. And from what I'm hearing, and there are no official details let out there yet, what I'm hearing, this is what they want. This is what they need. So I'm hoping ending that whole, we're just going to use AI to write everything. I'm hoping that people can make a living doing this so we can get back to watching the shows and the things that they produce for us. Now, over the weekend, I spent the weekend traveling through Ohio and Michigan, visiting striking workers in my quest to promote the Adopt a Worker, a Striking Worker program. And I'm hoping you find a picket line, you get out there, you adopt a striker for a day, walk in their shoes, talk to them, hear their stories, hear their complaints, and hear their pride and passion for the work they do. Now, look, there are a lot of people, they're just greedy and all that. No, these are people who are passionate about their work, proud of it. In fact, the folks at the Jeep picket line, when I drove up in my Jeep, were cheering the guy driving the Jeep. And I got to tell you, the Jeep people were fantastic. Took me around, we talked to everyone. I had, just some incredible conversations. And they have a track in the Jeep facility for the Jeeps to play on. Because I was joking with my son that, my Jeep is going to its birthplace. Going back, it's kind of like going home again. And we were joking because it literally has a track that you can drive, like rocks and, all kinds of obstacles that evidently before Stellantis took over, they used to bring in professional drivers and drive this thing on the family picnic days. Stellantis did away with the family picnics. And again, this is part of what we found when we were talking to people. This idea that during the pandemic, they were They were essential. They were frontline heroes. They were out there doing the work that made a quarter of $1 trillion in profit for the folks at the very top. And they're a little hurt by what's gone on. They're a little angry about the fact that they were promised, you know, the concessions they made to save these companies would be brought back, that they would be made whole down the road once everyone was doing well. And that hasn't happened, and it's not happening yet. There's some very good talks at Ford. We'll see. But this is that battle. This is that fight. And I had the opportunity to talk with people in both worlds, the folks who were there 40, 50 years, and the people who have been there 5, 10 years. The people who remember when this was those jobs were the gold standard of the working class, and how, you know, one income supported a family very well. And how now you've got couples who are working in there trying to make ends meet. And this idea that they want to leave something better for their children. In fact, in the Wayne, Michigan area, we went to the Ford plant and talked to a guy who was there 52, 50 some odd years he spent in that plant. And he said, look, you know, I'm okay. I'm going to have my retirement. I've made, you know, enough money that I'm going to be okay here soon when I retire. I'm worried about that guy over there, my friend. I'm worried about those people across the street who are walking the picket line, who are my coworkers and my friends, my union brothers and sisters. I'm worried about them and their families. I'm worried about their children. And the idea of a legacy, the quote unquote legacy employees, are worried about their legacy and what they're going to leave for the next generation. And I find that just really great. Now, Ford, you know, for all the talk of things going better, have now come out and said, well, maybe they're going to stop construction on an EV plant. Which is, again, you know, trying to send a signal like Stellantis said, we'll move to Mexico. And as we talked about Jim Cramer, I'd move them all to Mexico. You know, put those workers in their place. But I thought Sean Fain had the right frame. He said, this is shameful. This is a shamefully barely veiled threat by Ford to cut jobs. Closing 65 plants over the last 20 years wasn't enough for the big three. Now they want to threaten us with closing plants that aren't even open yet. We are simply asking for a just transition to electric vehicles, and Ford is instead doubling down on their race to the bottom. And this got me thinking. Based on how weird our economy is set up, which is telling CEOs and the wealth class, make as much money as you can because you're going to get praised for it. Make as much money as you can because you're going to be a rock star. I think Jim Cramer said that, you know, we should treat CEOs like professional athletes and pay them accordingly. And you go, well, wait a second. We have an economy based on those CEOs figuring out how to squeeze the quarter until the eagle screams that we hand to workers. So squeeze wages down to you know, barely getting by, cut benefits, cut little things like the picnic at the Jeep plant, cut the things that make employment, you know, tolerable, that make, you know, the working for a company enjoyable and what you want people to be. No, we're going to gut all of that. And then we're going to use that money. We're going to use that money to then go after, you know, government and get tax breaks and get all kinds of stuff to get bailed out when we get into trouble, because they know, hey, the politicians don't want people, their constituents, losing their jobs. They're going to come in and help out. And then, you know, pushing for deregulation and more power and more control. We've got all of the wrong things in our economy. And it's the voting, it's the working voters who have done this to ourselves. Because, you know, when I tell people, you know, you've got the CEO of GM or Stellantis or Ford making a couple hundred times what the average worker makes, people are like, well, you know, they're what? What are they? They don't put a single lug nut on a car. They've never wired anything. They've never bolted a trunk on. They've never done any of that stuff. In fact, I asked all of the people online, have you ever seen the CEO? Have they, you know, pitched in, got some gloves and done some work? No, they do nothing to add to the profitability of the things, the product being made. But what they do, and they do quite effectively, is they squeeze the workforce. What they do quite effectively is they fight for more for them and less for everyone else. And this comes back to us. This comes back to us as a culture. We keep going, you know, we want tax cuts. We've been trained like Pavlovian dogs that anytime we hear the word tax cut, everyone foams at the mouth. Oh, yeah, I've had the tax cuts. Yeah, yeah. And yet we're we're in a moment where tax cuts, you know, have gotten us into really desperate conditions because we have given so much to those at the very top. You know, the smart people, you know, the people who know what to do with the money, make more for themselves. At the expense of all the rest of us. There has been a massive redistribution of wealth in this country from the people who actually show up and punch the clock and do the labor to those who, well, the hardest day's work they do is move money from one pocket to the other. And this was, you know, what we talked about as I was visiting these workers on the line. The people who were there, you know, 20, 30 years ago, they remember how good it was, how good the companies were. And this, you know, globalization has a huge part of this. I mean, you look at Chrysler. The one guy was trying to tell me all the people who have owned Chrysler over the years, you know, Daimler and, you know, just a bunch of them. Cibris and, you know, going back and forth. And you go Fiat. And every time what happens is these companies come in, they suck all the technology out, they squeeze the workers for more. And it's all about, again, squeezing the quarter till the eagle screams. More profit. And we keep hearing the same frames from our corporate-controlled media. How come I've not heard any of the pundits of the financial world question why we're paying executives who do nothing productive? They do nothing to add value to the vehicle that you put your behind in and pay your hard-earned cash for. They do virtually nothing to produce that. And yet somehow we justify their millions of dollars while saying, someone doesn't deserve 25. It's really kind of twisted. It's really kind of bizarre. And it comes back to us. And this is why, you know, when we were on the line, I got this great t-shirt that said, respect the power of solidarity. As these people came together and as they're out walking that picket line, they know exactly why they're there. Now, I've been on picket lines over the years where not everybody quite was on the same page, and give the UAW credit for the education process. And I would argue this is what happens when you have a member-led organization. This is what happens when you have a member-led strike, which is what this is. I know they keep trying to box in Sean Fain as a union boss, but he's only putting forth what the members are asking for, what the members want, what the working people want. And I know that's hard to understand. I know it's hard for us to grasp, given the fact that we don't get to see it very often. But we're in this second where, you know, the tactics that they're using are pure democracy. Now, I love how Axios framed this today, And I'm glad that, you know, they put this out here because, you know, Sean Fain's acting an awful lot like a politician because of this election, acting a lot like the politicians promising stuff. And you go, he hasn't promised anything. They wrote the automakers are frustrated, not just by the UAW's tactics, but what they say is misinformation spread by the union. Now, the auto companies have, GM has responded, saying that, you know, UAW's demands are unattainable and refusing claims made by Fain and workers that they work at poverty levels. They said the bottom line, Fain is operating more like a politician rallying the constituents than a backroom union boss. And some industry observers wonder whether he's over-promising and what he can deliver. Not what every person to a man, to a woman on those picket lines said. These are our demands. There's no union boss telling us what we're getting. This is what we put forth. So it's not Fain saying that this is our demands. This is, you know, 150,000 workers saying this is what we demand. And this is what we stand for. And look, every one of them knew that they weren't going to get everything they asked for. But it was the first time in their memory that their union had gone to the bargaining table and told the world, this is what we're fighting for. And whether they get the 40% raise or just 25, They fought for something. Whether they get the 32-hour week work week or not, it's brought it into the American lexicon. We're now going to talk about that. Good things, historic things are going to come out of this strike. But I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. I'm going to take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So the shutdown's coming. Look, I don't see any way McCarthy's going to be able to spin this starting on Tuesday. I think the crazy caucus is going to be only crazier, more emboldened. And in fact, you had Donald Trump come out and say that he's called for congressional Republicans to shut down the federal government unless, and this is all in capitals, all capital letters, because he shouts this stuff in his Truth post, unless you get everything. That's everything. Every bit of wish list thing. Shut the government down. Cost the taxpayers millions of dollars. Because, oh, by the way, did I tell you that these shutdowns, not free? That you do have to pay the workers. You do have to pay the extra work, the overtime. All this is on the taxpayers' back, and they don't save anything. None of the government shutdowns that we've had, and this is one of those things you go, duh, none of these have saved a dime. But it's a nice display. It's a nice opportunity for crazy to get their name on television, to get their face on television. And you go, when do we go? Now here's fun. This is fun. I always love this. I always love this part because they want to keep the impeachment inquiry going. Granny, you're not going to get your check. The national parks aren't going to be open. The Smithsonian's closed. You and the VA might not get the care that you need as quickly as you need it. But the impeachment inquiry, oh, that's going to have to go forward. Now, you go back to Trump's comment, got to get everything they want. What do they want? Well, I mean, clearly, they've told us, and it's one of those things that at some point we've got to listen. They want to steal Social Security. They want to destroy Medicare. They want to force you to work until you drop dead. They want to remake the 20th century. That's the goal, and they've been very clear about this. It's not hard. It's not hard. And they want to defund, you know, they want to do Putin's work of, you know, we're not going to give any more money to or help to Ukraine, which, again, I'm not quite sure why this is their drop dead point, but it's another one of those things. Now, like I said, I think McCarthy is going to have a rough week, and it will be what decides his fate if he's going to be speaker, because as we said when he got the job. And I was very clear that I wanted the job for him because I wanted him to have the heartburn and the acid reflux and the heart palpitations that come along with the kind of stress that his own members are putting him under. But will he have a job? Because he did the dumb thing. You know, one person can seek to vacate the chair. Oh, it's going to be entertaining. But cost us millions and possibly billions of dollars. Let's go to the phones. I got Alice on line one. Alice, how are you?
I'm okay. How are you?
Whoa. You're not insane?
No, today's the day you need to worry. I'm not insane.
Okay, now I'm worried. What's up?
smart move, yes. Get the popcorn out because it's going to be interesting. You know what they want, the Republicans. They want to do away with everything and remake the 21st century back into the 8th or 9th century A.D. But they also are hoping that they can stop all these inquiries about Trump and his cronies. That's what they want. I mean, that's obvious. And now I'm going to flip the switch and go over to the CEOs. Are you aware of the fact, and this has been proven by more than one poll and what have you, that one out of every five CEO of every corporation is either a psychopath, sociopath, or narcissist?
Only one in five? I find that to be very low.
I do too. But if you stop and think about it, that would mean five out of every 25 or 20 out of every 100. So, you know, that's obvious too. And they aren't worth the money that they're getting paid. I never understood that either. No one is worth. And I'm talking athletes. I'm talking actors, politicians, what have you. No one is worth $15 or $20 million a year. I don't care what they do.
I am thrilled if they make $15 or $20 million a year. I hope they make $100 million a year. As long as we have a tax code that the good socialist President Dwight Eisenhower was in charge of. If we're taxing at 92%, I'm thrilled with it. Go ahead, make as much money as you need, and then we'll redistribute it back to we the people and for the things that we need, like roads and bridges and schools and healthcare and all of those things that we've been giving up for far too long. And this UAW strike is a perfect example of this, where you've got these executives who are just lining their pockets with obscene amounts of money and then telling the people who actually do the work, sorry, we can't afford to give you back what we stole from you.
Oh, absolutely. And then we end up having to bail them out, along with the banks and the credit unions and what have you, you know, when everyone does the stupid stuff. You know, we have been trained to worship, the sociopaths. You know,
to say,
oh my gosh, you know, they're so special. They aren't. But you have a good evening, Rick.
Thanks, Alice. I appreciate it. Now, look, you know, she's right in this. You know, we have given so much power and control to a handful of people to control how our economy works that. You know, I keep waiting for that shake awake moment. And I'm hoping this is it. You know, I remember, what was it, August 19th, 2019, when the business roundtable, you know, our captains of industry, our corporate titans, our oligarch came out and said, you know, we've learned our lesson. You know, we're going to start caring about, you know, the environment and consumers and workers. We promise we're going to start caring. It's no longer about maximizing shareholder value. No. It's about more. It's about, you know, society and being good stewards of the economy and being, you know, good citizens of the country and, you know, patriotic. And, you know, the flags were waving. The music was playing. You know, people were pounding their chest. Oh, boy, corporate America's learned. They're going to do better. Oh, boy, they're going to be better. And then the pandemic hits. And what'd they do? Nothing. They did exactly what they've always done. They squeezed the workers as much as they could. Although this time they did give them nice titles, you know, like essential and frontline heroes. And oh, thank goodness. And they put out flags occasionally for them. You know, heroes work here. Now, we don't pay you like that. But, you know what's a little PR, a little, you know, pat on the back every once in a while? It doesn't cost that much. What'd they learn? They learned that we're not going to fight back until now. You look at all these strikes that are going on. These are angry working people. And this is why, again, I come back to, I support wholeheartedly a adopt a striking worker program. Every union should be promoting this, not just for their members, but for everything. And bring your kids to a picket line. We should be doing that in huge numbers. Because it's their future that they're fighting for today. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, Rick at thericksmithshow.com. We'll take a quick break. Right back after this. If you miss any portion of the program, make sure you grab the podcast. Wherever you find your favorite podcast, you'll get ours. Also, something I said got on your under your skin, on your nerves, or you agree. Always like to hear some agreement. Rick at thericksmithshow.com. Right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1882. That was the day the first Labor Day parade took place in New York City. But whose idea was it? According to the late Jonathan Grossman, former historian at the Department of Labor, the first Labor Day occurred during a general uptick in working class organizing, strike activity, and militancy that year. Peter McGuire, Carpenters Union General Secretary, is often credited as the father of Labor Day. But others assert that Knights of Labor machinist and New York City's Central Labor Union leader, Matthew McGuire, was the force behind the holiday. The machinist McGuire had been active in the eight-hour movement and later as a Socialist Labor Party politician. By the end of the decade, 400 cities nationwide celebrated the first Monday of September as, quote, a general holiday for the working man. It was already an official holiday in most states when the labor movement started campaigning for a day of recognition at the federal level. Labor militants contend that by 1894, the holiday was promoted for its respectability against the more radical May Day. Another unanswered question remains regarding President Cleveland's motives for signing the federal legislation. The widely accepted view is that Cleveland hoped to win back labor's vote after federal troops crushed the 1894 Pullman strike in early August. But the president signed the legislation much earlier on June 28th. The nationwide boycott against Pullman cars, called by Eugene V. Debs and the American Railway Union, had just begun 2 days earlier. Did he hope to deflate the boycott? What do you think? For many in the Chicago labor movement, the fact that both Labor Day and May Day are linked to the city's history is a source of pride.
Labor History in Two brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
Oklahoma troubadour Woody Guthrie wrote a song about outlaws that was right on target. As through this world I've traveled, I've seen lots of funny men. Some will rob you with a six gun and some with a fountain pen. That could apply today to Clayton Bennett, a multimillionaire Oklahoma City banker who has regularly wielded his fountain pen to loot public funds for his private gain. Bennett is a Hall of Infamy player in the elite club of big league owners of pro basketball teams, specializing in picking taxpayers' pockets to finance his operations. In 2006, he and a few high-rolling partners bought the Seattle Supersonics team, promptly demanding that locals pony up $500 million to build a new arena for them. No, said Seattle. So Bennett and gang scampered off to Oklahoma City with the team, renaming it the Thunder. Then they used their fountain pens to filch a $215 million subsidy from local officials. Gratitude? Robbers don't say thank you. They refill their fountain pens. As Judd Legum reports in his excellent Substack report, Popular Information, Bennett is now demanding $850 million from Oklahoma City taxpayers to build a glittery new basketball palace for him. Legum notes that this is about $3,200 for every Oklahoma City household, and that Bennett's take will deplete the budgets of about a dozen essential community projects. He also has an inside accomplice, the mayor. Having taken Bennett cash to get elected, Mayor David Holt is now warning taxpayers to hand over millions to his rich banker buddy, or the Thunder will leave town. This is Jim Hightower saying, so go! The thieving won't stop until the people stop the thieves. Boom, 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 ship the whole herd of thundering thieves out of town, including Bennett and that pusillanimous mayor.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So you might remember on Friday, we were talking about AB 316, a bipartisan bill in California, overwhelming support by both parties to ensure that there is a qualified safety person behind the wheel of every autonomous truck in California. Thought it was going to go through, sail through the governor's office, pretty easily, because it sailed through the legislature pretty easy. Wildly popular with the public, and yet Governor Gavin Newsom evidently decided, nope. His statement, curious, he said Assembly Bill 316 is unnecessary for the regulation and oversight of heavy-duty autonomous vehicle technology in California, as existing law provides sufficient authority to create the appropriate regulatory framework. Now, people that I've talked to, they're saying bunk. And what I'm telling you is what I said on Friday. The first person who gets killed because of one of these autonomous trucks goes off the virtual rails, it's on this guy. And here to share some thoughts on why. In fact, he probably vetoed this as my next guest and I were talking about how important this is. That's why I've asked Jason Rabinowitz to come talk with us. He's the president of Teamsters Joint Council 7. TeamstersJC7.org is the website. Jason, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, thank you, Rick. Glad to be with you.
So am I getting this right? Right about the time that you and I were talking, the governor decides, no, we don't need this. We got it covered.
Yeah, well, late on a Friday night, after refusing to meet with the Teamsters General President, Sean O'Brien, refusing to talk to workers about this issue, he cowardly vetoed this bill, which is, as you mentioned, overwhelmingly supported by the public, overwhelmingly supported bipartisan, by the legislature. And it's a great disappointment that someone that was supposed to be a friend of working people, that said he was going to be on our side, you know, when his job was on the line, he was getting recalled. He came to the Teamsters, he came to the labor movement and said, hey, back me up, save my job, I'll be there with you. And we did save his job. Now our jobs are on the line and he's not there with us. And he chose the greedy tech companies and robots and profits over safety and working people, jobs, our communities. And it's really unfortunate. But, you know, this is just the beginning of this fight, Rick. This is the fight for labor of the next decade or more, to protect our jobs and our safety from robots, from AI, trying to take all our jobs. And our fight continues. This is far from the end. In fact, it's just the beginning. We'll continue to fight as Teamsters with the rest of the labor movement, with the rest of our communities, to protect our jobs and safety from these robot trucks and all the AI that they're trying to bring in to take our jobs just so they can boost their profits.
Now, I got to tell you, you know, when I first saw the veto happen, you know, my mind went to hope. You know, I'm going, you know, he's a Democrat. He wants to be president. You know, clearly someday he wants to be president. He's certainly not going to choose the wrong side for no reason. So my first thought was, I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt. Maybe he sides with me in that this doesn't go far enough. It's too much of a compromise. No, we need stronger protections instead of this being a person sitting watching the computer. Maybe he thinks that the computer should be helping the worker. And I would be on board with that. But his statement, curious to me, because he says that California law, as it exists, provides sufficient authority to create the appropriate regulatory framework. Do you see that? Do you buy that? Is that possible?
Well, working people don't buy that. Nobody buys that. He wants to put this monumental issue in the hands of the Department of Motor Vehicles and let them decide. And, you know, a decision of this magnitude needs to be made by our elected leaders, by the legislature, by the governor, and not punted to a regulatory bureaucratic agency. And we've been in front of the DMV on this very issue because they moved to issue regulations that would authorize robot trucks out on the freeways. And that's what started this whole thing. And we went out there, we had drivers, Teamster drivers, and our members testify in front of the DMV, and they were totally dismissive of drivers, of workers. All they wanted to listen to was these tech companies who were lying and talking about how safe this technology is when we all know that it's not safe, it's not ready. And so it's clear that the DMV is not taking workers seriously, is not taking unions, our safety, our community seriously. They're too cozy with the tech companies, and this decision should never be in the hands of DMV. So when he says that that the DMV is the right place for this decision to take place, he's dead wrong.
You know,
and we reject that entirely.
You know, over the weekend, my son and I we were traveling through Ohio and Michigan to visit UAW picket lines, and we happened to catch a Guardians baseball game. And as we're sitting in the heart of downtown Cleveland, in the stadium with, you know, 15, 16,000 people, my cell phone got nothing. I could Google nothing. I could search nothing. Nothing whatsoever. Couldn't text. Couldn't do anything because too many people on the system. We've bogged down the system. So immediately as I'm sitting there, I'm going, now imagine rush hour traffic coming in to downtown Cleveland, into New York City, into Washington, D.C., into Los Angeles. Imagine all of those trucks on this virtual rail, this 5G that we're not sure works yet. I'm sorry, it may be safe for one truck with 50 people watching it, but I'm sorry, a million trucks on the road with nobody watching, I got real problems with this.
Oh, well, yeah, and we saw what happened in San Francisco. There's about 1,000 of these robot taxis on the road. There was a concert there. A bunch of people came in the city, jammed up the cell phone network. Next thing you know, all these cars are stalling out all over the city because the cell phone network went down. And Cruz and Waymo say, oh, well, it's not our fault. It's the cell phone network. Well, no. What if you said rush hour traffic? What if there's a disaster, an earthquake, a fire, and the network goes down right at the moment we need our streets clear for the ambulances and the fire trucks, and all these robot trucks, robot cars stall out because their signal goes down? What if the signal goes down when the truck's going, you know, 50, 60, 70 miles an hour down the freeway next to some family in their minivan next to our kids? The technology's not ready. And these tech companies don't care about that. They just care about our profits. So that's why we need our elected leaders, like our governor, to care about us. But in this moment where everything's on the line, he turned his back on us. And, you know, we're going to remember that. And if he wants to run for president or dog catch or anything in between, we're going to remember this moment when our jobs and our safety were on the line. And he chose the greedy tech companies and the robots over us.
So where do you go from here, Jason? Because, well, you know, obviously he vetoed this, and I'm with you, kind of like a thief in the night. I don't know why you do this, you know, on a late night Friday, but this is what the governor chose. Because I think that's more of a slap in the face than vetoing it, to be honest. Because it's like, well, they won't notice. They're off for the weekend. This will blow over by Monday. I stewed about it all weekend, and I wasn't even on the campaign with you guys. So where do you go from here with this?
Well, he can try to hide out on a Friday night, but workers are going to remember. And this fight has just begun. The vast majority of the public supports our bill, supports this idea. The vast majority of the legislature, Democrats and Republicans, support it. So we're going to continue to fight on the legislative front, and we're going to fight on every front to make sure that we continue to protect our jobs and our safety from these robot trucks. You know, his veto message was so disingenuous, Rick. It said, this is inflexible approach and this stops innovation. This doesn't stop innovation in the least. It doesn't stop them from running a single autonomous truck on the road. All it says is that if they want to run these robot trucks, they have to put a human operator in there to ensure safety. And their hypocrisy is totally exposed by the fact that they oppose this, because if they really thought it was just about safety, like they claim, these greedy tech companies would be very happy to say, okay, we'll put a human operator in there to ensure safety. That's a belt and suspenders, right? They claim their trucks are so safe, but if there's a problem, there's a human safety operator. No, the truth is that they're trying to eliminate jobs, human driving jobs, because they want to save money and boost their profits. And they're willing to put driverless robot trucks 80,000 pounds on the freeway before the technology is ready, endangering all of our lives just to save a buck.
Yeah. No, I mean, in the example you gave, the example of the taxis is a perfect example. If the taxis can't work, if you can't make little things work, why are you going to the biggest things on the road?
Yeah, it doesn't make sense other than because you want to rush it out before it's ready in order to eliminate jobs and boost your profits.
No.
And that's where the unions come in, and that's where our elected leaders should come in. And I'm glad that our legislature stood up and did the right thing. And I'm embarrassed and disappointed by our governor, who was supposed to be our friend, who cowardly took the side of the greedy tech companies instead of working people in safety. And we're going to remember that when it comes time for him to run for anything else. We know where he stands.
Let me ask you this. Your general president, Sean O'Brien, tweeted out today that the bill has 95% bipartisan support in the legislature, 75% public support. And yes, Newsom killed it. For those of us who don't know California politics as maybe as well as we should, or the mechanisms of how they work, I think every state has a way to overturn a veto. With 95% bipartisan support, is that a possibility that the legislature can overturn this and say we're going to put it into law? How does it work in California?
Well, no question. In California, the legislature can override with 2/3 vote of both houses. We got well more than that when we passed the bill to begin with. So we're looking at all our options, Rick, and we're looking at the best way to bring this thing back. I can say that, you know, we have the right to reintroduce it. We have the right to look at an override, but the people want this. The legislature wants this. We're not going to let one man who's too close to the greedy tech companies to stop us from protecting our jobs and our safety. So we're looking at our options, and we're going to be moving forward. But this is just the beginning.
Now, I visit California. I want you to have it because I don't want to be driving through there. And I also know that California is a driver for policy across the rest of the country. So if you guys can't seem to get this done, I don't think Mississippi or Florida or any other places that I've been are going to consider that either.
Well, I, you know, this is why California is so important, because we do think that it sets the tone for policy elsewhere. But, you know, this is a bipartisan issue. This is not a Republican or Democratic issue. There's plenty, you know, we had a Republican co-sponsor. Almost all the Republican legislators voted for this thing. And we've seen in lots of deep red states where the people and the legislators are standing right in the same with the same idea that we are, that we need to stand up to these greedy tech companies. We need to stop these robot trucks from coming in. I think it's going to happen all around the country where people are going to stand up to this.
See, this, to me, this isn't a bipartisan issue. This is a nonpartisan issue. This should not be at all partisan, because, look, I don't care who vetoed it or who approved it. That truck comes careening down the road and runs off the virtual rails and kills somebody I know. I don't care if they wore a red hat or a blue hat. I just know that this should not have been allowed to happen. Before I let you go, I got to get your thoughts on the news today that there's a tentative agreement in the Writers Guild strike. That they've pulled down the pickets for now, pending ratification. Any thoughts?
Well, yeah, labor is resurgent all over the place, where workers are fed up with corporate greed. And, you know, you've got these very powerful and rich entertainment companies that, you know, it's just like with the robot trucks. They want robots to write the screenplays and they want robots to act in the movies. They want to take people's labor writing the scripts and pay them peanuts. And the workers stood up and courageously took the strike, and they held on, and they ended up getting a tentative agreement that's recommended. We're very proud that the Teamsters Union and especially our Hollywood local 399, under leadership of Lindsay Doherty, who's an international vice president, stood up for the writers and for the actors, and made it clear, if you got a picket line on one of these productions, our Teamster trucks are not going through there. We're standing in solidarity. We're proud that the Teamsters Union has helped in our way to contribute to this win. And, you know, workers are going to keep standing up, whether it's UAW, SAG-AFTRA. My local 2010 is potentially going to be on strike against California State University, together with all the other unions there, very shortly. Workers are fed up, sick and tired of the rich getting richer and enriching themselves, like these CEOs with their huge profits and their huge executive compensation, and expecting workers to accept peanuts for the work that we do that makes them rich. And so I'm very proud of the writers for their fight, and they've set a great example for the rest of labor.
Yeah, I mean, this, you know, I had framed the writers' strike and the Screen Actors Guild as the front line of the class war, the war on technology. I mean, we're getting beat up by robots and AI and all this. This is the beginning of that that tech fight, and I'm anxious to find out what came out of this and you know the good things that they got out of this. But here's the thing, because clearly our politicians aren't going to help us. It's something that we got to do for ourselves.
And workers are doing it. Workers are standing up everywhere from in every industry. And it's a great moment to be part of the labor movement because we're fighting and we're winning like we haven't in a long time. So we're just going to have to keep up the battle.
There you go.
And, you know, we've got these greedy tech companies. They've got a lot of innovations, Rick, a lot of good new technology, but there's nothing innovative about union busting. There's nothing innovative about underpaying workers and trying to take away their jobs and take away their livelihood. And so we're going to fight that tooth and nail. We welcome innovation, but we will stand up to union busting and exploitation at every turn. And I'm proud that the Teamsters Union is part of this fight.
Amen. Jason, I appreciate you taking time for us. Come back and talk to us again soon, especially as the strike that you've got coming up comes online. I'd love to hear more from you. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Rick. Anytime.
Our good friend Jason Rabinowitz, he is the president of Teamsters Joint Council 7, TeamstersJC7.org, the website if you want to keep up with the work that they do. Going to take a quick break, back with your thoughts. Stick around, listen to the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Have the talk.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1961. That was the day when Herbert Lee was murdered just outside of Liberty, Mississippi. He was a successful black cotton farmer who became active in efforts to register black voters. Lee had 9 children. He was one of the few area black farmers with a vehicle. This made him very valuable to the voter registration movement. Lee would drive Bob Moses from the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee around Amet County to reach unregistered voters. It was dangerous work to register black sharecroppers and farmers in rural Mississippi. Attempts by black residents to gain legal or economic equality were met with threats and violence. On the morning of his murder, Lee had come to the Westbrook Cotton Gin just outside of Liberty to drop off a truckload of cotton. There, he was met by a childhood friend, Mississippi State Representative E.H. Hurst. Hurst came up to the truck and started shouting at Lee. Then he took out a gun and shot Herbert Lee in the head. Witnesses stated that Lee had brandished a tire iron at Hurst. Hurst claimed self-defense. A jury declared the murder was justifiable homicide. Lewis Allen, a black farmer and timber worker, was one who had testified about witnessing the shooting. Later, he recanted his testimony, saying that he had lied about Lee threatening Hurst because he feared for his life. After Allen began to talk about what he actually saw that day, he became the victim of harassment and beatings. Finally, on January 31st, 1964, he too was gunned down in his driveway. No one was ever convicted or even arrested for his murder.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in 2.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Wow, I just got a text from a relative who lives back where I went to high school. Wow. Evidently, the
Civic
high school
media radio stations providing your news, conversations, and fun you won't find anywhere else.
Evidently, the coach has resigned after his term was. Evidently, he used a Nazi slur. Used the word Nazi repeatedly as a term to call out plays during a game in Beechwood. Evidently, the student body in Beechwood is 90% Jewish. I wonder if that had something to do with the audible and the play call. I just kind of spitball. It's scary. I mean, the area I grew up in, which was, again, solidly a working class, unionized, you know, upper middle class-ish, you know, hardworking area, a lot of blue-collar workers, you know, having, you know, gone the Trump way. And, you know, this is a sign of, and again, what I said from the beginning was, where I grew up, those folks believed all those jobs that they lost because of bad policy Trump was going to bring back. They truly believed that. They internalized it. You know, look, Cleveland, where I grew up, was a very segregated area. So racism and misogyny were, in my youth, were the norm. All of the things that they're accused of. But it wasn't that moved these people. It was the economy. It was the jobs. And it's the undercurrent of what's going on now as well. Because the economy is, on paper, doing pretty well. But read a newspaper, read our news accounts, things not good. The messaging that the corporatists and the right wing have put out is everything's horrible and it's all Joe Biden's fault. And yet the economy that he inherited from Trump was terrible. Massive unemployment. And yet, you know, Biden has done, in my view, a lot of the right things to move us in the right direction. And it's hard to not remember the chaos of the Trump years. So a little chaos today. Evidently, Marjorie Trainwreck Greene took Donald Trump gun shopping. Chaos rules the day. Now, remember, this is how Trump ran government. Everything was chaotic. He walked out of a gun store with a gun he can't have. The same way he tried to walk out of the White House with thousands of documents that he can't have. This level of entitlement. And we'll call it Glock Gate. Evidently, there was a Glock that had a picture or an image of him on the handle. And he's taking a picture with it, all smiles, you know. And he said, you know, he was going to buy one. And, you know, he said, you know, I got to have one of those. I want to have one. I want to buy one. And the initial reporting is that he bought it, which then sent all the people scratching their heads because someone under federal indictment, you know, 91 felony charges, can't buy a gun. So in public, in front of us, with his future VP, because I'm thinking, you know, he's trying some of them out, he openly commits a federal offense. Now, immediately all my left friends are going, we should lock him up for this. I'm going, no, I don't think he bought it. And then the news report comes out saying, no, he didn't buy one. You know, and then they tapped it back because they realize, oh, you know what? That's a federal offense. Now, I, from the beginning, said there's no way he bought it. There's just no way he bought it. And I had a friend go, well, why wouldn't he buy it? Because did he think that he was breaking the law? No, he doesn't care about the law. He could care less. He could shoot. Remember, I can shoot someone on Fifth Avenue and not lose a vote. He doesn't buy anything. He's used to stiffing people. He's used to getting stuff on the arm. Walk into a restaurant, you know, hey, I'm Donald Trump, on the arm. He fancies himself a mob guy. He would never reach into his pocket and spend $900 on something he doesn't need or want or just pay. So, you know, this is the weird thing. Now, again, that flaunting of the law, pretty powerful on that side. And this is why the gun fetishists love him so much. And that flaunting of the law part, you know, this was all performative is what it was. This is, you know, get me a little media attention. Endure me to my gun fetish friends. Now, if a gun was transferred to him, whether he did buy it and they zeroed it out for, no, we'll just let you purchase it or we'll just give it to you. That's still a crime, as I understand. And that's the thing that you know, gets me. If he did walk out of there with a gun, it's not him who should be in trouble. It's the gun owner. It's the gun shop owner who should be the one. And are you telling me that the guy who was owning the gun shop, clearly a supporter of Trump, didn't know he was under indictment for 91 felonies? And again, was that not the performative part to go, hey, look at me. I'm a good Trump gun nut. Come do business in my gun nut store. I think I'm right on this. The point of the whole thing, the whole point of the whole dispute.
You're listening to The Shaw.
WAUK 540 AM Jackson. W266 DR Waukesha.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.